All right, ladies. Up.
This is Jason Albert, and you are listening to Nordic Nation from Faster Skier. Long before the Here Comes Diggins call by Chad Salmela at this year's Olympics, he was known throughout the ski world as an athlete and sports commentator. In what now may be considered his spare time, Salmela is a running coach at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth, Minnesota, and the voice of Nordic sport for NBC for this upcoming season's World Cup cross-country ski events and IBU World Cup biathlon events. We spoke to Salmela last month for the podcast before his commitments with NBC Sports began. We'll start with Salmela talking about growing up as one of five kids in the household.
I was the second oldest kid of five kids. I grew up on the Iron Range of Minnesota. My dad was and still is an architect. He got hired in, we kind of skied as a family. We were, you know, we're 100% Finnish. So we skied as kids. It was kind of a family thing to do. And my dad got us on skis when we were young. I was probably skiing when I was two, but I really was kind of a chubby, grade schooler and enjoyed being sedentary. I was always fast, you know, I could run across the gym faster than anybody in my little class. I mean, we were from a really small hamlet. So I always felt like I was, you know, a quick kid, but I got into like watching, syndicated shows like the Munsters and the Andy Griffith Show after school every day and eating Cheetos or whatever my mom would let me snack on. And I got a little, and I think I'm pudgy by nature. I mean, I think I always have been. It's not like I could be really fit and trim really easily. So as a kid, I was a little bit pudgy. And then my brother got it. I would like to ride my BMX bike around the dirt mining roads around our home. We lived right by the biggest open pit mine in the world at the time. And so I was not a very active kid. I kind of knew I could be athletic at a young age. But I rode my BMX bike around, and then my brother got into bike touring and then bike racing, road bike racing. And that's kind of where I started really competing. As I competed, I think from age, I think 11 to 13 as a road bike racer, just kind of citizen races. And we tried some USCF racing early on in our careers, but we didn't really like that in Minnesota. And then I skied the first race I ever skied was a 32 kilometer Vasalopet in Mora, Minnesota at the age of 11. And I think I got beat, by like an hour in my age group. And I think I was fifth or sixth in my age group. And I determined after that, so I think I was 11. I determined, okay, I'm going to win the 11 to 12 age group category the next year. And I did. I started skiing, and my brother kind of got me into it a little bit. And that was the start. I won this huge trophy. To this day, it's probably the biggest trophy I've ever won. I was 12 years old. And I had to ski 32K for it.
Now, is that on like on a mantle anywhere, or is it like have dust on it up in the attic?
It's somewhere. I think it's packed in a box, probably in my stuff somewhere. And I have, if you press me to find it within an hour, I don't think I could. So that was kind of the impetus. And then one really major thing happened. And there was a bankrupt alpine ski resort in Bowabic, Minnesota, called Giants Ridge, that the IRRB, the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, bought that venue. And, you know, they wanted to make it world-class at something, the IRRB did. And they realized it wasn't a big enough hill to have, you know, to bring in international competitions in alpine skiing. So they brought in Al Merrill, who is very famous for it. He did the trails in Lake Placid and I think in Calgary. He's an East Coaster, coach at Dartmouth for a lot of years. They hired Al to design the trail at Giants Ridge, and it became kind of like the it place for Nordic skiing in the 80s and early 90s. And I lived 30 miles from Bowabic, and that's kind of where I got into competing and, you know, started doing what we called JOQs back then. And I was one of the top kids in the upper Midwest for my age, off and on, depending on how I was skiing. And I found my way into biathlon at 19. At 16, I tried it. And by 19, they hired Walter Pickler from Germany, who was an Olympic bronze medalist. And I got talent ID'd sort of, and they kind of put me on the national team as a youngster. And that's kind of where my ski career kind of took off.
So you are also a longtime coach. And I'd like you to tell folks where you're based. And I know recently you transitioned from cross-country ski coach to, I believe, cross-country running coach. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, your past as a ski coach and kind of what made you transition into like, I'm going to give up the ski coaching gig for a bit?
Yeah. So, I didn't really know I was going to be a coach, but I got tapped to be a coach right when I quit. I retired after not making the 98 team for the Olympic team, which, you know, in my mind, I definitely should have made it, and I didn't. And it was my third try, and I decided to move on. And I was only 27, so I was pretty young when I quit. But my coach then, Olga Shalna, who was a longtime national team coach for USBA, he said I was going to be a coach. That was kind of his edict. And he kept me on. I had to finish school. So in 98 and 99, I ended up getting hired by the US biathlon team to be the assistant coach right after quitting competing. And I was still pretty young, you know, I was in my under 30. But I learned a lot from August in those years, and I learned a lot working on my own. I actually left the national team at the end of my career, even though they were going to put me on. I left it and went home and kind of drank what I learned about myself. And that's when I had some of my best years as a biathlete. But, you know, I think I got into coaching that first year, and those first 2 years in 98 and 99, and I was really tapped to like dial in the be more of a technique coach, trying to get people to ski a little more forward. I was writing some articles that were semi-controversial around that time about a lot of the stuff that is commonplace today, you know, not laying, sitting back with a deep push. And I think that's probably where I maybe got a more of a reputation as a coach, was talking about those technical issues in the national dialogue. But then that was a very short-lived thing. I did that for 2 years on the side of being in school at Middlebury College. And then when I graduated in 2000, I was hired to start a development program for kids who were pretty good skiers or vice versa, or good shooters who really need to learn how to ski better. And that's like the Barn Sisters from Durango were part of that group. And I coached that group for about 7 or 8 months, if I remember correctly, and they ran out of money, and I didn't have anything going for me. So they hired me. The Salt Lake Organizing Committee in 2000 needed a sport coordinator at Salt Lake for biathlon, and I got hired after the USBA ran out of money to pay me. I kind of landed softly in a nice job at the Organizing Committee in Salt Lake. And I kind of went on hiatus for coaching there for those 2 years. And that's kind of where my commentating took off. I did the PA for the World Cup events and for the Olympics for biathlon and a couple of the cross country events at Salt Lake. And then after that, after Salt Lake was over, I didn't really know what to do. So I moved back to Duluth, got my real estate license, and started coaching high school running at the Marshall School in Duluth. Did that for 4 years. And then, St. Scholastica decided they were going to start a cross-country NCAA ski program, which I thought they would do it wrong and do it poorly, like most people try to do when they start a ski program. But they told me all the right things. I went into the interview, and I was interviewing them as much as they were interviewing me, and I was one of the three finalists. And I kind of told them what I thought they needed to do to be competitive in NCAA skiing, and they liked what they heard, and they hired me to do the job. And I did that for 10 years. I did that from 06-07 to 16-17. NCAAs, I think 2016 was my last year as a ski coach.
Okay, and you are a cross-country running coach now?
That's right. Yeah, at that time. So there were a couple of things. There are a couple of things I saw like as strategic for me. I haven't really made it public, and this is probably the most public I'll ever make it, but I was diagnosed that year with Parkinson's disease, early stage Parkinson's. So I was getting a little shaky and not being able to feel skis very well when I was wax testing. And I talked to some people. One of the really great guys that has helped me out through all this is Davis Finney, who is a former pro cyclist who lives in Boulder. I met him at the NCAAs right shortly after being diagnosed. And he told me point blank, I need to find ways to de-stress my life. And ski coaching, and everybody who's a ski coach out there know that being a ski coach is not a stress-free way to make a living, that's for sure. So, you know, that wasn't the only reason. I knew that there was a rumor of an Olympic channel coming along, and there are all kinds of things. And I just thought, like, if nothing else, I mean, I love coaching. One thing I should say, I didn't just, you know, scattered distance running. I was already coaching as a ski coach here. I had been coaching several elite level runners. One of them was one of the top 10 female marathoners in 2011 in the country. So I was already using some methodology that I thought was really valid and interesting. And running is always, I was a high school runner. That was the only sport I did for my high school. And I've always really been fascinated with distance running and the differences between that and skiing. So it wasn't like I just took this leap into distance running. I was already coaching runners. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm coaching. I'm winding down my third season as the cross country coach at the College of St. Scholastica, and I'm also the distance track coach. So,
okay. Do you find that it's like markedly less stressful at this point? You know, 3 years in.
Absolutely. I think distance running. I think distance running has some inherently easier things about it that are a little less stressful. I think the one of the things that I identified very early in my coaching career at Scholastica as a ski coach was that I felt like I could get a leg up on some of my the schools I had that had more recruiting power and scholarships that I could on day of I could probably maybe wax our team into the race a little bit more, and that became less and less true as more and more people got more into waxing skis. But just the process of waxing even at a college level with Pure Floros, I mean, I really enjoyed the challenge of it. I liked the tactics of it, but what I didn't like was the wear and tear and the living in a ski mask and touching fluoros all day long and potentially breathing them. That and what that whole process did was it really took the race day coaching out of it, because in order to get really fast skis, you have to like really be committed to doing that. And it's hard to have conversations, race morning conversations with your athletes when you're really focused on getting them the best skis they can. And distance running doesn't have any of that. It's much more about training, your training stress cycles. It's much more about identifying, you know, technique and gait and stuff like that. But it's really, I think it really is much easier for me to have relationships that are meaningful with my athletes than it was as a ski coach. Not that I didn't have meaningful relationships as a ski coach. It was just easier to be a coach on race day. And that really, spoke to me, and it still does.
Well, that is actually really good insight. Yeah. I mean, you know, as a parent, you notice that you're like, oh yeah, that there's a coach over there. They're just, you know, over the ski bench for five or six hours. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is one podcast I listen to that's like it's a Slate podcast having to do just with general sports, but they're really smart guys. And I heard you interviewed shortly after the Olympics, and I was like, wow, okay, this is like, this guy Chad is making it big time here. If he is on this if he's on this podcast, I mean, do you remember that interview with those guys?
I do. Yeah. That was, I had no idea that they were held in such high regard. I just took the interview and gave them what I could say.
You know, I'm curious, you know, let's take a step back. You have been involved with a television or web broadcast for a while now. And, you know, I'm curious, you know, how has that changed for you in terms of time, commitment, and how you prepare?
Well, it just changed a lot. With this gold pass, you know, I've been doing this on the side, and it's really ramped up since I quit coaching skiing here. The last 2 years have been the busiest I've ever had. And I was doing probably between high 20s to low 30s shows, days on air with, the Olympic Channel or NBCSN. And then the Olympics every 4 years, but, that got ramped up. This year we're doing the full IBU World Cup, every event, the full FIS Cross Country World Cup. Doesn't sound like NBC has the rights to the World Championships yet. I think they're asking an arm and a leg for them. So that might change, but right now Worlds are not on the docket for Seyfeld. But that decision to move to cross country running, as far as preserving my ability to be employed as a coach and doing what I love to do, has been a good move because I was getting to a point where I was going to have to choose between being a commentator or being a ski coach. And, and even just physically, ski coaching was becoming a challenge. So it was it was pretty good foresight, I think, at this point, looking back to make that transition, because I'm still coaching, which is what I love foremost to do, but I do like commentating on skiing and making it exciting for the American public. So, you know, we're going to 70, I got 70 days booked at this time for NBC. So it's a lot of days. It's a lot of travel away from home. I got two small kids, well, not small, a 9 and a 7-year-old, but it's busy. I'm going to be more in Connecticut than I'm going to be home for those 3.5 months. But yeah, it's changed. I think that, I don't know if it's necessarily our popularity as a sport is growing. I think with Jesse and Keegan's win, it definitely helped. And there's no doubt that there's a groundswell, and Jesse and Keegan and Keegan's fight with cancer and Jesse's high profile. I think the two things have very profound effects on our sport in the public eye and in good ways. And I think, you know, Keegan's bringing awareness to breast cancer is pretty big for somebody as young as her. So I think we're having impacts that we didn't even really foresee with the gold medal that was won. And you know, for Keegan, it's a horrible, horrible thing, but her courage and where she is with her fight it's a very profound thing that puts our sport and the people in it in a very positive light, I think, with a disease that a lot of people have to come to grips with.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like a responsibility? I mean, as a conduit between the general public, I mean, there will be the hardcore fans that obviously tune in and watch, but now, right, because of all the stories you just brought up, there'll be other folks.
Right.
You know, how do you sort of prepare yourself mentally to be like the conduit for Nordic ski culture and racing at an understandable level to your, you know, common viewer who might be tuning in because Jesse Diggins is racing?
Right. That's been probably an underlying theme of my entire career as a speaking broadcaster for these sports, is that, just to give you an anecdote, I was hired probably, it must've been 3 or 4 years ago now, but, the English speaking people were really excited about what I do with as a commentator. And, they brought me in to do some webcast, IBU based webcasting for the world feed online. And, you know, Max Cobb did a lot of groundwork to make that happen. He was very excited. And I don't know if it was a political statement or what, but the European guy in charge of IBU was like, "What's so great about this guy? He talks to people like they're stupid." And that's exactly what I do. Not that they're stupid, but it's like I talk to the viewer like they've never seen the sport. And that comes from a focus of doing that for the Olympic Games, which has astronomically big audiences. And I realize, and I've known for years, that the focus to bring the commentary to that level really infuriates insiders and people who really are sports fans. It would be like coming into a football broadcast and talking about how the football is shaped and how it's thrown and how you carry it when you run. I mean, nobody does that in American football. But in order for football to get a foothold on a European broadcast, that's probably what they need to do. And that's really kind of where I've been pushed and pulled. Is if anybody has any criticisms about the job I do, who are people like you or people who read Faster Skier, I understand that. I understand that I'm not saying the things that they want to hear necessarily all the time, and that I might be speaking down to them, but I think there's a very real need for that when it's a broader audience. And I think the IBU guy had a point. If I'm talking on the world feed and I'm explaining the size of the target and the wind flags and all that stuff on the IBU website world feed, maybe that wasn't an inappropriate time to be doing that, because you got to assume that the people who are tuning into the IBU website know their sport. And so there's always that push and pull that I have to play with, and I'm very cognizant of it. I think you have to, and if you're going to do these things, if you're going to put yourself out there in a public manner, and even, you know, this is relatively small compared to the people on network television regularly, but you have to be good at letting the criticisms roll down your shoulders and just off your back, or you'll go nuts. You know, you'll go nuts. You can't possibly make everybody happy. So I try to find that happy medium.
I think that not making everyone happy, and like learning how to roll with criticism is a good life lesson for anybody to, to be honest. I mean, I mean, I tell my kids all the time, I'm like, oh, read this email that someone sent me that, you know, it's like, you just have to kind of have a little bit of self, just keep a little smidge of self-esteem going each morning.
Exactly. So
from a technical standpoint, you know, I think you mentioned you have 70, you know, broadcast days, coming up this year. You know, how do you prepare for that? I mean, what might that look like? You know, if you can inform people of how you might, you know, you're looking at spreadsheets of prior race results, names, or what have you.
The great thing about 70 dates is that I need to do less prep, because you're more prepped the more dates you do. If you go from race to race, you've got obvious and very recent benchmarks that you can refer to fill in the backstory. It's when you have a very sparse amount of time on television that you have to prep more. And as I've gotten older and I've gotten away from being more friendly personally with the athletes that I'm commentating on, like in the early 2000s, I knew most of the people on the podium or in the mix of the race, you know, on a first name basis. So it was very easy for me to just announce off the top of my head and be very accurate in recalling what Sven Fischer did at the Olympics in 2000 or in 1998, you know, or whatever the stat might be. But I have to prep more now. I don't know if it's just because I'm older or my memory's getting worse. I've had a pretty good memory my whole life. I used to be in some bands and one of my bands called me the Robo Memory because of the way I could just pull lyrics out of my head. That, you know, so I definitely have had, at least in the past, a very good memory. I remember some of my brother's childhood for him, you know, things like that. So that helps. I mean, having a good memory definitely is a big part of it. But as I get older and I'm a little less connected personally with the athletes that I'm commentating about, I have to prep a little more. And a lot of that is reading. I mean, just reading Faster Skier, or I do a lot of translating of VG. You know, I'll just go on VG or NRK and I do speak fluent German, so that helps. I read German biathlon websites, and if it's something too technical, I'll just translate that as well. But for the most part, I can read the German biathlon websites and get what's going on. So those, you know, there's some. I think being the best prep is being generally well informed about your sport and knowing what's going on. And then beyond that, if you're going to refer to things, you need to have something in front of you there that is going to be accurate, because what a lot of people don't realize is you can't just cock off on NBC networks and come up with stuff that isn't true. You know, they're going to fact check and they're going to get mad at a guy who does that, and they're not going to hire you back. So you can't wing it. So you have to prep a little bit. And if I always have the rule, if you think something's forming in your mind that you're going to say that you're not 100% sure about, don't say it at all. And come back to it and maybe look it up during a commercial break and come back with it if you can. But I like anybody has said something wrong or I misidentified somebody. But when you have a time to fill in the backstory and you do it willfully, not knowing and not prepared, that's when you start getting into trouble.
So you are forever at this point, I suppose, you know, will be linked with the gold medal, you know, the team sprint gold medal in Pyeongchang from the sense of your Here Comes Diggins call.
Yep.
Do you feel any added pressure now? It's like, okay, do I need to come up with zingers every broadcast? I mean, I'm just curious, you know, sort of what that's done to your psyche as you think about how you might be judged, you know, with each particular race call.
Well, I hadn't given it much thought, but now you're making me think about it.
No.
I mean, the guys pointed out that on that podcast, they pointed out even that I had said I had used some things that I had used before. And I think that I wasn't thinking of that. I mean, I go back and I realize that I said yes a couple times when Lowell Bailey won the world championship too, because he got in 3 seconds under Andre Moravec's time when he won that 20K. And I don't know, maybe that's cheating. I don't really know, but I don't particularly care at this point. I'm going to call things the way I see it. And if that gets exhausting or repetitive, then somebody younger will come up and replace me. You know, so there's going to be somebody out there who's going to do this job when I'm done, or even, you know, push me out of it. And I've always had the sense when I do this that every job I do, I'm lucky. I've gotten to do it, and I got to call that moment. And I've just been grateful for what I've been able to do, and I don't look forward that much. I just feel like, you know, what's the point? I'm gonna try to bring the sincerity and honesty that I've brought in the past to the future calls I make. And if I get repetitive, I'll try not to repeat. I don't think I want to say "here comes anybody" anymore, because right. It's so overdone. I mean, people ask me to do it all the time, and I refuse to, because I don't want to cheapen the moment, and I can't replicate something that was right. Really quite emotive for me. I mean, I don't even remember it right. You know, I watched it the first time, like, wait, is that what I said? You know? So, you know, when you're so personally invested from such a long period with a love affair with a sport, and then that a moment like that happens, that you kind of go into another place. And I think I kind of did. And I probably won't go there again, because that moment's passed.
Do you know, to kind of bring you back to the moment of that race, I mean, I remember, you know, be like every day folks in the mainstream media would show up. Is this going to be the day? You know, is this the day that Diggins was having like a killer Olympics? You know, at the top of my head or something, you know, like 3/5 places. I mean, just steamrolling, really. And was there a sense on that first or second lap? I mean, I can speak for myself. My perspective was sort of looking at that last big hill before they came around and descended into the stadium. And I, you know, you could certainly tell that Keegan was really on. I mean, she wasn't losing any ground. So, you know, so what was your sense about, like, oh, you know, this might be a moment?
I knew pretty early on. I didn't know they'd win, but I was pretty sure they would. I knew after the semis. I watched the semis. We called the semis for NBC. I don't know if anybody even remembers that we called the semis for NBC, but we did. And when I looked at the results and I saw the performance, first of all, I'm gonna throw this out there. The reason I thought that they were going to win is because that was an event custom made for those two people. Jesse Diggins is a 5K freestyler. She and the closest thing to a 5K freestyle, besides the 5K freestyle, which really doesn't exist as an event, is the team sprint. It's going hard and recovering and going hard and recovering. And Jesse Diggins is the best in the world at that event, freestyle team sprint. And Keegan Randall was coming into form, and she's one of the best sprinters of all time, and she's experienced. And I just felt like when I watched that semifinal and I looked at the times, they gapped. I think it was 13 seconds they were faster than Norway's semifinal time. And they look comfortable. So if they're 13 seconds up on Norway and they're right there with Sweden to win the semifinal, they're going to win the final. And but why I knew it was going to happen. I mean, I wanted to see Keegan's last lap, but when Jesse went on the second lap out of the stadium, her middle lap, and that surge she put on that kind of made Stina hurt a little bit. That's where I knew, because I felt like, okay, Keegan's got one more lap. She's not going to lose more than, you know, worst case is 5 seconds. And if Jesse can do that to Stina, that 5 seconds is not surmountable for Norway or Sweden. And then I started wondering when they came down the hill into the finishing stretch and Stina was ahead of Jesse. I was like, oh, maybe I'm wrong. You know, maybe I'm wrong. And that's where I think the Here Comes Diggins really was. It wasn't canned because it was in question. And you know, it would have been far less exciting if Jesse had led down there and led all the way to the finish. But the way she did it is the way she wanted to do it, I found out later. And it was an extremely exciting way to win the first gold medal for the United States.
Yeah. It was pretty, pretty special. I was oblivious to any sort of, I don't think I ever watched any NBC coverage. I don't think until I got back. And then I heard your call or heard about it probably when I finally got back home. I don't recall, but yeah, I was sort of in a, as you probably can imagine, in like a media void.
It was a pretty weird kind of surreal surreal night. I mean, we were in the booth and we called that race, and I let off a huge scream after we went off the air, and they actually edited it back in because the mics were still open. They edited it into a highlight reel, that scream that I did after the finish. It was kind of surprising that they do that, but they clearly liked what I did. But, you get done with the call, you kind of talk about it with the crew that was there, and then you step out into a sound stage that's black and deathly quiet because it's all foam insulated, and there's nobody there. And, you know, I got an ovation from the sound techs at the end of the hall.
Oh,
which was
cool.
Really cool. That was about there were four of them, and they just said great call. And I was a little worried it was over the top. I was a little worried I was being a homer, but I was assured by my producer that it was great. And I went packed my stuff, went home, went to sleep. And about 9:30 the next morning, my phone just started buzzing, and it did that for about 4 days. So it was pretty cool.
That is cool. And that's all based out of Stanford, Connecticut. Is that right?
Production? I was in Stanford. Stanford. So yeah, dude, I think we called that at 2 a.m. or something like that.
That's about as far away as you can get in the East Coast from like good Nordic skiing, I think.
It's not like being at the event. That's for sure.
Well, anything else you want to add? And people will find you calling on the, you know, and I know I've tried to get this straight. So it'll be streaming. You'll be streaming your broadcast, or calls will be streaming on the NBC Gold Pass, which is online.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like you should almost call NBC and ask them, because they don't really share that with us. All I do is show up, and I do. If I'm involved, it's going to be a produced show. They're not going to put me with a microphone on the internet. That's not what NBC does. Like they don't do even what Eurosport does or any of these other streaming things. They just don't do it. They if they're going to use commentators, they're going to make it into a show for American television. It's going to feel like an American TV show. And the reason they're doing that is they're trying to normalize it. They're trying to normalize the expectation of an American audience is that it's going to look like TV. And I think that's probably what's going to happen. But as far as the gold thing sounds like it's on demand. So like once it's out there, you can get it. And you can watch it whenever you want, which is honestly, for being in the continental United States compared to continental Europe, is actually pretty cool. Like you can avoid, you know, getting up in the middle of the night to watch and avoid the media, the social media, and then watch your show when you wake up at 9 a.m. or whatever. It's actually kind of a cool thing. And I do know that most anything that I'm doing is going to air on one of the two networks, NBCSN or Olympic Channel.
And that's like a subscriber cable.
Network. Yeah, that's cable. That's what NBC, you know, I mean, the gold thing is kind of moving into modernity for these guys, for NBC. And that's kind of, I think everybody realized that that's where things are going, that the mobility piece is really important, but it's still really rooted. The whole thing is rooted very much in traditional television broadcasting feel. That's what NBC, at least as far as I've ever worked with them, I've never done anything kind of like, I did World Biathlon Championships once by myself on NBCSN or what used to be WCS. I don't remember what they call it. Universal Sports. When it was Universal Sports.
Right. There's been so many iterations.
Yeah. And that was like literally the only time I think anybody in Colorado at that place had ever done a show with one commentator, you know, cause it's just something you don't do. And
hard to develop chemistry when
right,
it's
and
just
they did that
you.
Because Biathlon wanted to buy the time and air it, and all the that's what they were going to do. They're just going to have me do it, and I did it. And I played the. It's hard though, being the color and play by play all by yourself. It's not a fun way to go.
Well, thanks for your good work, and thanks for your time, and
no problem.
Really appreciate it. So I've wanted for, I have to say
right,
like since I heard that podcast, I was like, why aren't I talking to this guy? You know, it's just took me a bit, but I appreciate you making the time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you find yourself on snow soon.